Thanks for listening to Matt McLaughlin History. Become a subscriber to receive exclusive bonus episodes, ad-free listening, early access to all episodes, and special member-only events. Click on the link in the show notes or visit patreon.com/mmhistory.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, it's Matt McLaughlin, and welcome to a brand new season of Living History. That's right, we're back. We've got some really exciting things coming up for you this year. But in the meantime, while we're putting those in place, I thought we'd revisit some of our most popular episodes from previous years. We've done hundreds of episodes of the podcast. We've done some pretty special episodes previously that you might have missed. So for the next week or two in the warm-up before we release the new episodes, I thought I'd share with you some of my favorite episodes from previous seasons. So please enjoy this episode of Living History, and I'll see you with the new episodes very, very soon. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Living History, and this week marks a couple of very special anniversaries. Of course, on the 11th of November, it's Remembrance Day, the day we stop and think about all the men and women who've given their lives during times of war. And I hope you all take the opportunity to pause at 11 a.m. on the 11th of November to think about the hundreds of thousands of Australians who've given their lives in times of war for our country. But the 11th of November also marks another anniversary. It was on that day in 1880 that Ned Kelly was hanged in Old Melbourne Jail, or Melbourne Jail as it was known at the time. And I thought, what a great opportunity to go and learn a bit more about Ned Kelly, because he's one of the most iconic Australians, and we all think we know the story inside and out. But like most chapters of history, there's always more to learn. So I took the opportunity to go to the place where Ned Kelly was hanged, the Old Melbourne Jail, and one of the wonderful guides down there, Trevor, showed me all around the jail. We visited the cells where Ned Kelly stayed before he was hanged, the site of the gallows where he swung from, and various other sites in the prison associated with the last days of Ned Kelly. It was a really fascinating visit. You can do it yourself when you're in Melbourne. They do guided tours of the jail, and I strongly recommend you go down there and check it out. So I hope you take the opportunity to pause and remember on November 11 to remember all those who gave their all in times of war. But also, I hope you take a moment to enjoy this exploration of the character that was Ned Kelly.
This is the Living History Podcast, broadcasting live across the airwaves.
Trevor, we're standing here in a relatively modern courtyard outside the jail, but this is really where the story of Ned Kelly's final days begins, doesn't it?
That's right. He arrived here straight from Glenrowan after over Knighting and Benalla, and they brought him here from North Melbourne Station into the hospital that was in the middle of this courtyard. Now, he was very ill. He had just come from a shootout with the police where he'd ended up with 28 bullet wounds in his arms and legs.
28 bullet wounds?
28. Most of those were from shotgun pellets, I think, but they're still wounds, they were still bleeding, he was in shock, so he was in a pretty bad way. In fact, they were scared he was going to die. And they didn't want him to die. He was the only survivor. The other three members of the gang died at Glenrowan. They didn't want Ned to die because they wanted to hang him. And they were certain about that. So he went straight into the hospital here, and he was there for 6 weeks while they got him well again. So it would have been a pretty traumatic time for him. Infection was a potential problem. I read that he had his own waterbed, which surprised me. I didn't even know they had waterbeds in the 19th century, but apparently there was something like that to sort of ease the pressure on his wounds.
He would have been an incredible amount of pain as well.
I thought so, yes, yes. I mean, we're talking about 1880. There's not much in the way of really good medicines around.
And you mentioned shotgun pellets as well. Without being too gory about it, the 19th century arms would have caused some pretty grievous injuries, you would expect.
They would. The police had Martini Henry rifles as well, and they did real damage if they hit you. Big bullets. They would hit the body, make a small hole, tumble over on the inside, and burst out the back with a great big hole out the back.
That's a large caliber projectile.
It is. And if you see Ned's real armour, which is available in the library here in Melbourne, on the breast of the armour, there's a sort of a little bump coming out. Well, that was made by a Martini Henry bullet. The gang put the armour up against a tree to check to see if the bullet would go through. So that's why it's weird, because when people look at it, the bullet's obviously hit from the inside and they think, well, what happened? Did it go right through? No, it was before it was even worn. So it would stop a Martini Henry bullet, and that is an indication of how serious the armour was. 5 millimetres thick, made of steel, and heavy.
Imagine the noise and the concussion when those bullets smacked into that armour.
Exactly. And not just that, the damage it did, because it pushed the armour back on his body. So when they hit him in the head, in the helmet, pushed it back against the face, cut his nose, his eyebrows, bruised him. He was in a bad way and would have looked, I think, pretty terrible at the end when they took the armour off.
So he spent 6 weeks in the hospital over here, and then what was the next chapter of his fate?
The next chapter was that they decided the luxury of the hospital was no longer for him, and he was to be taken from the hospital and into a cell in the old cell block on the other side of the yard. Now, it was a cell where he was looked after. They tended him pretty well, and the governor of the jail at the time, Castillo, seemed to have a degree of sympathy for Ned. He seemed to get on quite well with him, but he could be heard exercising in a small yard out there, and they could hear the clank of the chains on his wrists and ankles as he walked around. But he was there for about 8 weeks, and was taken out of there, off to Beechworth for an attempt at a trial there. It became pretty evident very quickly that he wasn't going to be found guilty if he was tried at Beechworth. Too many mates around the place. So they brought him back here, and they tried him in the courthouse on the corner here. That in itself was a bit of a circus. The trial was supposed to take 1 day, according to the judge, Redmond Barry. Because Barry was a bit worried. The trial's taking place at the end of October, and Barry is a horse racing man, and he is worried that if the trial just spins over and over and over, he's going to miss his spring racing carnival and not get to the Melbourne Cup. So he decreed 1 day only. As it turned out, it took 2 days, but the result was obvious. Kelly was found guilty of murdering one policeman of the three that he did shoot. They kept the other two in reserve in case they needed him if they weren't successful with the first, but they didn't need it. And Barry's condemnation of Ned, he didn't hold back. He didn't like Ned. And Ned remained quiet through the trial. He wasn't allowed to give evidence. That was the rule at the time. They relied on a very, very green lawyer that they had hired in a ploy to try and play for time, which didn't work. It backfired. And this guy, in my humble opinion, I'm no lawyer, just wasn't up to the job. And a lot of opportunities were missed. The result being that Ned was found guilty and sentenced to death.
And then he came back here, obviously. This was where he came to meet his fate.
He did. In fact, the sentence itself was theatrical. After the judge did the usual thing, you know, the black cap on the head and to be taken from this place to a place of execution, to be hanged by the neck until you be dead, that was all very solemn. And then Ned himself looks at the judge, leans forward, points at him, and says, "I'll go further than that. I'll see you where I'm going. So if you're going to send me to hell, I'll see you when I get there. 12 days after Kelly hangs here, the judge mysteriously dies.
Ned's revenge.
The stuff of legend, yes, yes. Well, they brought him here after the trial. He stays in his cell over there where he's watched because he's now a condemned prisoner and they don't want him to commit suicide and cheat the hangman. And then on the morning of the 11th of November, about 9 o'clock, they bring him out of that cell and they walk him across the yard past the hospital here, where he pauses to admire the flowers in the garden. He walks right where we're standing here, where there's a door to the jail. Sitting outside the door, I'm not quite sure where, here or there, there's a sort of a gurney, a stretcher on wheels. That's going to take him back out. I don't know whether he notices that, but it would be there and in through this door.
We're standing now in front of a very heavy timber door, painted green, obviously very old. I mean, how long has this section of the jail even been here?
This building, they started building it in 1852 and finished it in early 1859. But this section here, the tower here, which includes the gallows, was not open until 1865. So it's got a fair age on it.
And it was a new facility in Ned's day. So So talk me through. So Ned Kelly, right where we're standing, he approached this door.
Okay, he would have come up to this door. There's a great big knocker on the door, which I really love, and I reckon someone would have gone, and the door would have opened, and you're faced with the stairway up to the gallows. So he would have walked through this doorway, up these stairs here. I don't know how many guards he had around him. I don't think he would have been over-guarded because he still has... he's had his chains taken off by now, but he's still, I don't think, walking terribly well. He still suffers a bit from his wounds. Up these stairs and along the landing here and into the cell next to the gallows.
Just to paint people a picture of what we're looking at here, it is a foreboding multi-story chamber in this old jail. Everything you'd expect an old jail to be. And oh, I can see the gallows looming over us there and the cells up above. I mean, I suppose this is exactly the sort of place they would want their condemned criminal to see in his last hours.
Dark, gloomy, a reminder that what you've done and what's going to be done to you. Yes, this is not a nice place.
Well, let's head up the stairs. Walking up the stairs in the footsteps of Ned Kelly. Pretty extraordinary.
They always brought their condemned people to the cell because it was so easy to get someone out of here onto the trapdoor and through the hole. A good hangman could do it in less than 30 seconds.
Well, we're standing, it's 2 metres from the rope, from the door of the cell to the rope. It's quite extraordinary. So let's go into the cell.
Because it was built after the majority of the jail block here, the cells are bigger here. So we had a little bit of room to stretch out. But it needed to be bigger because they had other people in here. While Ned was in here, he had his opportunity to make his last confessions and things like that to his priests. They were in here. He had about an hour just finishing things off, if you like, ruling a line under his life. And then the sheriff arrives at the door and demands the body of Edward Kelly. And this is the signal for Governor Castillo to hand over responsibility for Ned from the jail to the sheriff. And so now Ned is totally in the last leg of the system. At that time, the cell door on the opposite side of the gallows, the mirror image to this cell, that door opens, out comes the hangman. Now, he is a character. He's one of only 21 men who did the job of hangman in Victoria. No women, it wasn't a fit job for a woman. And they were all pretty weird. And Upjohn, I think, is right up there. He is one of the weirdest. He came from Ballarat, which is not in itself weird, but you know, he was about my age. He was in his about 60. He had never done this job before in his life.
he got the job because the regular hangman had taken off. He'd quit. And so they'd called for volunteers here in the jail, and Upjohn had volunteered. And they'd agreed he'd do the job, and they said they would pay him £5. That was his emolument. I think that's $300 and something today. Now, he'd been in jail many times. He was a prisoner here, as most of the hangmen were, and he'd had a pretty long list of weird crimes, things like stealing trousers, collecting sewage without a license, spreading sewage on the streets of Ballarat, going to the toilet through the window of a train. And at the time he was in jail, when he hanged Ned, he was in jail because he'd been caught in a chicken coop without a lawful excuse. And the glorious thing, when the newspapers reported on that crime, they'd noted that the chickens were very disturbed. Well, this is the guy who's got this responsibility. It's his first. He's never hanged anyone in his life before. So he comes across, and in this cell, he prepares Kelly to hang, which means he ties his arms back so he can't grab the rope and interfere. He places a folded cap on Kelly's head, which is going to be pulled down over his face at the last minute so he can't see anything and doesn't know exactly when he's going to die. And then he puts a leather strap round Kelly's knees. They take him out onto the trapdoor here, and Kelly stands under the rope. Now, we've got a rope on the gallows now, as you can see. It's not a real hangman's rope, but it looks like it. They used a three-strand rope, and it had been carefully measured, about 8 feet long. And the rope was that long because Kelly was the weight that he was, about nearly 80 kilos, and they'd worked out if you weighed 80 kilos, you needed to drop about 8 feet. Now, to me, that seems a lot, but that's what they had. You had to drop that length because when you hit the end of the rope, you stop with a bang and your neck snaps.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
If your neck doesn't snap, you're in big trouble. There was a noose at the end of the rope, a great big knot. Upjohn puts the noose over Kelly's head, pulls the knot tight, and lodges the knot just under the left ear. They think that's where you put it to make maximum damage. And then he pulls down the cap over his head so he can't see anything else. And the next thing he does, he steps off the trapdoor and pulls the lever on the other side. There is a huge crash. And this wooden trapdoor on the floor just drops open. Kelly plummets down, hits the end of the rope, stops with a jerk, and his neck snaps. He's instantly unconscious. He doesn't feel another thing, but of course that noose keeps tightening around his neck. It stops blood getting to his brain and oxygen getting to his lungs. And in a couple of minutes, it's all over. Ned Kelly's dead.
How much of what we're looking at here, standing in front of the gallows, the huge beam, the lever, the trapdoor itself, how much of this is original that was here during the Kelly execution?
A great deal of it. When this jail closed in 1924, they took this stuff out and set it up in Pentridge Jail and hanged another 11 people there. But when they set it up in Pentridge, they had to cut the trapdoor to fit. And so when it came time to bring it back here, when Pentridge closed in 97, the trapdoor didn't fit in the hole. And we have the real trapdoor sitting in that cell there. It's a pretty awful thing to behold. But this trapdoor is a pretty good facsimile. And all the fittings, the hinges, the little rings to pull it back up again, and all the mechanism underneath, that's all original. The beam is original. The metalwork around here is original. That lever that makes it work is probably not original, but the original one would have been the same, and it slotted in and out. So you only put the lever in when you were going to use it so that you didn't have accidents. So it's pretty authentic.
Fantastic. Just in time for the school kids. Trevor, we're standing in front of the death mask of Ned Kelly. Why did they even make these in the first place?
Oh, they made them because they believed in those days they could tell what your personality and character was like by the shape of your head. And I think they had this grand scheme. If they made death masks of the people they hanged here, and they were convinced that they were all bad people, they could put those models together, study them, work out what a bad person's head looks like, and then apply that knowledge to groups of people so they could find out who was bad and needed watching. Now, of course, it's a load of rubbish, but it has given us these bizarre but amazing artifacts in the jail. And here's Ned looking exactly as he would have looked a couple of hours after he died. And it's quite stunning, really. He looks quite peaceful, which many, many people reflect on. There's no bulging eyes or anything like that. He looks peaceful. Of course, the accuracy of it is sometimes quite frightening. Some of the death masks in the jail, you can still see eyelashes in them that are pulled out of the body, and they're in exactly the right place. Now, this wouldn't have been the first model out of the mold that they made, because once you've got a mold which they made first, you can fill it with plaster as many times as you like and get as many death masks as you like. And Ned, of course, was a celebrity, so if you owned a death mask of Ned Kelly, that was a license to print money. But this must have been pretty close to the first off the line. I know where six of these are at the moment still. You can see them around Australia. So if they made 20 before, then six still remain. Of course, they're very fragile. If you drop that, you just end up with a lot of plaster crumbs on the floor. But this one, not just because it's Ned, but because it stands out from the wall in the jail here, is special. Because when you go round to the back, you can see the mark of the rope round Ned's neck. Absolute proof that he was hanged, and you can see it, just the fold of the skin round the back of the neck heading up to underneath the left ear, which is where the knot would have been placed.
Just extraordinary. You can see that quite clearly in the plaster, the rope mark around his neck. So what a piece of history.
It is. It's a real piece of history, and I have to admit, no matter what your impressions of Ned are, if you have to lift that death mask and carry it somewhere when you're cleaning or something else in here, it's special. It's special. Now, we can go forward a little bit after all that stuff happened, because once they made Ned's death mask, they took him out to a long skinny yard at the back of the jail and they buried him. Now, he stayed there from 1880 until 1929. They always buried the victims of the rope there, because there was a law passed that said if you were hanged in the jail, you were buried here as well. And that came to pass in part through what happened to George Melville in 1853. They used to give the bodies back to the families, and they would have a funeral and bury them and all that. But, of course, really early in the colony's history, there weren't families for most of these people, so they were just buried anyway. But in 1853, George Melville was hanged, and they gave his wife the body. she didn't do what was expected of her, and she took his body down to her oyster bar in Little Bourke Street, laid him out in the front window, surrounded with ice and flowers and ribbons, and for 2 days she used his dead body for advertising. And she stood out in the front of the shop and she spruced, "Here, come and have a look at my husband George, what those rotten people at the jail have done to him, and while you're here, come and buy some fish and chips." And this was reported in the newspapers, who reported that business was brisk. But of course the authorities got to hear of it and said, "No, you can't do that." And eventually they passed a law which said if you were hanged here, you were buried here. And that's why Ned was buried here. In 1929, the jail had been closed for 5 years, and they had decided to give all the land behind this building that we're in now to the Education Department, and the Education Department eventually built a school there. People pointed out at that stage that there was a cemetery here with the bodies of, I think, 49 executed prisoners in it, and the law said they had to be buried in a jail. And now they were no longer buried in a jail, and what was worse, they were going to be buried in a school playground. Not a good look. So they dug them all up and transported them to Pentridge Jail, where they dug 3 big holes, dumped them in there, covered them up, and promptly forgot where they put them. The bodies weren't discovered until 2008. They were dug up very carefully. They wanted to identify who was who, and in 2009 they identified Ned's body. When the coroner had finished with the bones in 2012, they gave Ned's skeleton back to the Kelly family. And in 2013, the Kelly family had a funeral for Ned and buried him in the little town of Greta up in the northeast. So that's where Ned travelled after his execution. But it didn't stop there. There's always been a story about Ned Kelly's skull. This seems to have been spawned by a Ballarat newspaper who wrote a report about medical students going crazy on Ned's body after his execution and chopping it up. They alleged that there wasn't a famous person's office in Melbourne that didn't have a bit of Ned Kelly in it, and his head was cut off and his skull used as a paperweight in an office. Now, this story gained quite a bit of impetus from people who were interested in Ned Kelly, and it was always assumed that that's what had happened. Now, when I first came to the jail as a tourist in 1970s, in one of the cells there was Ned Kelly's death mask, and right beside it, Ned Kelly's skull. Now, you knew it was Ned Kelly's skull because it had Ned Kelly written on it, but that's how it was advertised here at the jail. And that skull was stolen and eventually held to ransom. And we got communications from the person who had it in Western Australia offering to give it back if we could guarantee a decent burial for it and that sort of stuff. Now, National Trust was a bit embarrassed about this situation because we really didn't want to be dealing in human remains, and we probably shouldn't have had the skull on show anyway. But eventually, that skull was returned, and DNA tests were made upon it through one of the Kelly family still alive, and it was conclusively proved that the skull was not Ned's. So Ned's, that put paid a bit to the rumour, but the next thing that made it even surer that the skull wasn't Ned's was the discovery of Ned Kelly's skeleton at Pentridge. And we have a photograph of it here. And there's Ned's skeleton, and you can see a large chunk of the skull is still there. So this skull that they had here couldn't be Ned's. And what's more, the top of that skull, it's not a great photograph there, but when you look at the actual bone, it's been cut on the top. So it's been worked on during an autopsy, and there are a couple of other cuts around the body too, which suggests an autopsy. So really, the only bit of Ned's skull that's missing is this front piece here, and it wouldn't have been intact, it wouldn't have had any integrity, so it could be anywhere. It was a great mystery while it lasted, but the only part of that mystery that still survives is, whose skull is that?
Trevor, we've just come into one of the cells here, and there's a full collection. There's four death masks here in front of us of other prisoners that were executed. What can you tell me about these?
Well, I love this cell because it gives you... There's a great story for each one of these four men, but it shows you how accurate these death masks are. We're standing in front of Alfred Archer's death mask now, and if you look at it very, very closely, you can see he has a full set of eyelashes sticking out of the plaster. Now, that in itself's pretty ghoulish, I suppose, but those eyelashes have pulled out of the body into the plaster mould they made, out of the plaster mould and into that model, and they're in exactly the right place. Now, that is fine detail.
It's quite extraordinary.
The making of death masks, here we are there, it was a skilled job. A number of people made them here at the jail. One of the most famous was a bloke called Kreitmeyer, who owned a waxworks in Melbourne. And it seems that there was a deal that Kreitmeyer made the death masks, and he got the right to make a model for himself to show in his waxworks. So you would find the day after a person was hanged here, his death mask and model and the story of his life pops up in Kreitmeyer's waxworks for people to pay and go and see.
Trevor, you spend a lot of your life with the ghost of Ned Kelly, exploring these rooms. Where does he sit in your mind? Because some people think of him as Australia's Robin Hood, a real hero, a hero of the working man. Other people have called him a murderous thug. Where do you think he belongs in Australian history?
Well, it's interesting that you've identified that contrast, because that's a problem for me here at the jail, because I meet people from both extremes. Ned Kelly's a thug, Ned Kelly's Robin Hood. And, of course, the real story is down the middle. I find the story intriguing. I wouldn't mind an hour at a dinner table with him to sort of really see what he was like, because we've got his actions and we've got what other people have written about him, and we have his words in the Giraldry letter, for example, and we can sort of make an analysis of that. But he seems to have been a real character. People who knew him appear to have liked him. For example, I've never read anything written by a woman who didn't find him charming. I suppose that's the Irish coming out in him. But he was a tearaway. I think the word larrikin was invented to describe him right from a young age. He had a hard life, and a lot of people use that as an excuse for his actions, but a lot of people had hard lives back then. It wasn't easy being poor Irish in early Victoria, and Ned had those troubles, but other families and other people who had those troubles didn't necessarily become horse thieves, bank robbers and cop killers. And Ned did go down that track. He was born into a family that seemed to make a real art of stealing horses, and there's a long history of that in the northeast of Victoria, and Ned was drawn into that, so that's what he knew. He certainly had a very strong sense of injustice, and he wanted fairness. And really, that's not much more than everyone wants. Everyone wants fairness, and he saw around him a lack of that. His mother was poorly treated, according to him. He was poorly treated. The way he was treated here in the jail, not by the jail people necessarily, but during the court case, it wasn't very fair. And he was very aware of that. So I find him an intriguing character. There's a streak of, I don't want to say cruelty, but he was a hard man. There was no question about that. What happened at Stringy Bark Creek, where the three policemen were killed, is still controversial. People still argue about it. Did Kelly give the police a fair chance? Kelly always argued that he said, throw down your guns. One of them did. He survived. Three didn't. They were shot. Kelly also said that he was expecting them to shoot first and ask questions later. And he cited evidence for that, as other people have. Ian Jones, for example, I suppose the great go-to expert on Ned Kelly for years here in Australia, he contends that. But people who argue from the other side say, no, that was a fabrication of his imagination. So there are so many mysteries in this man, and I don't know if we're ever going to get any closer to solving them, because people are still writing about him. Every year, books and movies come out about Ned Kelly, because the story itself is absolutely fascinating, and the way he went about things, you know, his the intricately planned bank robberies at Euroa and Girildry, fantastic pieces of organisation, and very, very successful, right down to the absolute disaster of that last shootout at Glen Rowan, which was poorly executed and suicidal in a way. He's a man full of contradictions, and I don't see me in my short life ever being able to solve all of those.
Well, Trevor, thank you for your time in showing us the story of Ned Kelly in his final days. It's been absolutely extraordinary. Thank you very much for your time.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.